From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. A quick sweep of news headlines about guns in North Carolina shows stacks of stories about illegally obtained weapons. Two men made national news earlier this month by breaking into two gun shops in North Carolina and stealing more than 100 weapons. They were arrested by the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. But after multiple versions of that story, the gun legislation headlines begin to emerge. House bill could recognize gun permits from 16 more states. That's in South Carolina. States rejecting bills intended to keep guns away from kids. And fans can legally carry concealed gun at Georgia football tailgates. North Carolina is generally considered a more permissive state when it comes to gun regulation. There are a handful of pieces of legislation that have moved through the General Assembly this session that are raising concern both for those seeking more restrictive gun laws and the gun lobby in the state. Today, we're going to find out exactly where North Carolina happens to be, what the proposals are on the docket in Raleigh, and how those at the table envision a safer Tar Heel state. With us today is Don Arabian, co-founder and co-chair of Wilmington Faiths Against Gun Violence, an alliance of faith-based groups. Don Arabian, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Also with us today, Professor Richard Ogle. He is a clinical psychologist with specialized training in addictions, PTSD, and treatment outcome research, understanding the causes and impacts of violence specifically. Professor Ogle is also associate dean of the University of North Carolina Wilmington's College of Arts and Sciences. Professor Richard Ogle, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
And joining us by phone is Todd Adkins, Director of Research and Information for the National Rifle Association's Institute for Legislative Action. Todd Adkins, glad to have you with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And we're inviting your questions on this Wednesday. If you'd like to ask your own question about proposals for gun legislation or current gun laws in North Carolina, you can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Todd Adkins with the NRA, let's start with what you're trying to accomplish in Raleigh this session. What's the one piece of legislation that, if it passed, you would see as a key accomplishment this year?
I think we do have a number of issues we're working on, but probably the one that's gathering the most attention and certainly is among our top priorities is legislation that would extend the current law in North Carolina, which provides that an individual can carry a firearm openly without a permit, to actually extending that to allow for permitless concealed carry. And this is a measure that we passed in a number of states over the years, and it's gained a lot of steam nationally simply because what we've seen in the evidence in these states that have passed this legislation is that there have been none of the harmful effects that are alleged by those who oppose this legislation. And at the same time, what we find is that we're giving individuals their right to protect themselves and members of their family in the manner which best suits their needs. What we know about concealed carriers in this country is that they're exceedingly law-abiding. Some research even suggests they're more law-abiding than police officers themselves. And this is not an experience that is new to any of us. Certainly in North Carolina, as people recognize, we've had the right to carry in that state with a permit for a number of years. We've had open carry for decades, in fact. And what we know is that law-abiding citizens are the ones that, of course, follow the laws, and we don't have to be concerned with them. Those who break the law for whatever illicit purpose or misuse firearms, of course, don't really pay any attention or heed what laws are currently on the books. So that would be among our highest priorities in the state for this legislative session.
Don Arabian, your group, Wilmington Faiths Against Gun Violence, is doing a fair bit of lobbying this long session. What are you particularly working on?
Well, on the other side of what Todd's talking about, yes, we are concerned about repealing the concealed carry permitting requirement that currently exists in the state. That requirement ensures that somebody must be 21 years of age in order to carry a concealed in the state. And it does provide for training and an understanding of what current North Carolina law is, neither of which, and it's probably a bit illogical, neither of which occurs if you have a permit and decide to carry open. And there certainly is a disparity there. But we're supportive of things that mitigate risk. And I don't believe, we don't believe that we should erode mitigation of risk, but in fact, strengthen it.
And are you saying then that what the NRA is supporting, this idea of open carry and relaxing the age restrictions on the gun laws, that is actually upping the risk? Is that your contention?
It seems to me that anything that decreases the vetting process. Concealed carry tends to be the preferred default way in which somebody is going to carry in public for a lot of good reasons. I used to do it myself for a lot of good reasons. But you want to be careful when you start down a path that lessens that mitigation of a risk. And I think it's important that we have this kind of discussion. It's important to be able to sit down as we are today and to talk about the three-letter word gun in a constructive way and in a discussion where we're not just running to our various corners and yelling at each other about it. So this is an excellent opportunity to have that kind of discussion.
When we're looking at risk, Richard Ogle, describe the people that you've seen in your research who are most likely to commit violence and then gun violence. And are those two separate groups?
Yeah. I'm glad we're using that term risk. I think both Don and Todd and myself are looking at risk maybe in slightly different ways, but we're all looking at how to kind of mitigate risk. I do look at what are the risk factors that individuals and the context brings to the situation. The data do not suggest at all that there is a difference between someone who is going to perpetrate gun violence and someone who's going to perpetrate violence in general. And so I think the focus is on mitigating the risk of individuals who are prone to violence or at risk for violence to have access to guns.
And there are two general types of violence that you identify. What are those two? Or sorry, aggression, I should say. What are those two types of aggression?
Yeah, there are a lot of models of aggression, but I think the most useful one for this situation is to kind of look at what we call the difference between proactive and reactive aggression. And I think in most cases with what we call gun violence, it's a case of reactive aggression. And that is aggression that it serves a function of releasing anger, frustration to injure an individual who has somehow slighted you or has threatened you. It really is a type of aggression that is a response to threat. And different individuals will respond to threat differently. They perceive threat differently. And so to have processes in place where we can identify individuals and address them with intervention programs. And so my focus is more on working at the individual level as opposed to the legislative level around guns. How can we help individuals who've been shown to be at risk for aggressive or violent behavior as early as possible in their lives and have them engage in programs that mitigate that? We do know from the data that those programs do work, but it's a matter of putting the resources in the way and then being able to identify and follow through with that.
And I want to hear more from you a little later about how you identify people, what those signs are of someone who is at risk for violence or serious aggression. But first, let's sort of walk through what the North Carolina gun laws are on the books now. I want to go buy a gun, Don Arabian. I've never owned one before, and I'm setting up a hypothetical here. So I walk into a gun store in Wilmington, North Carolina. What's going to happen after I pick out what I want?
Okay, so let's say you want to buy a handgun. Currently in the state, before you're going to purchase or acquire a handgun, you have to obtain permit from your local sheriff's department in the county that you live. That's the first step. And that step requires a vetting process that the sheriff goes through, national and local checks, as well as the sheriff making a determination based upon his or her understanding of that individual in their county. Once you've obtained that permit, which acts as the same in the same way in one sense as a national check would do if you're obtaining it from a licensed federal gun seller, then you can go purchase the weapon, and it's one permit per one gun in our county. Handgun. This doesn't apply to long guns; just handguns.
And so I'm going after this handgun. What kind of things are going to come up? What kind of things would that gun dealer be able to see from my background?
Well, what's going to happen, the sheriff will have already done those checks, both national, state court checks, the national checks, mental health checks as appropriate. He or she can now go back 5 years, I think, based upon a change in law last year. Those checks will have been done, and you will show and submit that permit at the time that you want to make the purchase, or at the time that your Uncle Bob decides he's going to give you a .45.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about the gun laws, the current gun laws in North Carolina. We're going to get to what the proposals are on the table in Raleigh this long session, how those gun laws in North Carolina could change. With us today, Todd Adkins of the NRA, Don Arabian of Wilmington Faiths Against Gun Violence, and Richard Ogle, a clinical psychologist from UNCW. If you'd like to ask your own question of our guests this Wednesday, you can reach us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. It's an exploration of the current gun laws in North Carolina, which proposals are on the table in Raleigh, and how stakeholders view the issue. With us today to answer your questions, Richard Ogle, professor of psychology and associate dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, Todd Adkins, director of research and information for the National Rifle Association's Institute for Legislative Action, and Don Arabian, co-founder and co-chair of Wilmington Faiths Against Gun Violence. If you'd like to ask your own question on this Wednesday, you can do that by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Just before we went to break, Don Arabian of Wilmington Faiths Against Gun Violence, you were explaining the steps that I would go through to obtain a handgun in North Carolina. And you mentioned the sheriff would have done a criminal background check. Let's say I had no criminal history, but let's say I have some kind of mental health history. Richard Ogle, that seems like sort of, how does that even come up on a background check? Is there any way to flag that?
Not at this point in time. And I think really what's most important is to understand that that's a fairly slippery slope to flag. First of all, it really depends on how you define mental health or mental health illness. When you look at the rates of various psychological disorders in the population, they're really fairly high. And so the fear is that simply because I have a psychological condition, I can't own a gun. And that actually is a bit of a problem in the sense that it actually works in reverse, and it stigmatizes individuals with mental health problems, because the vast majority of individuals with mental health problems are not violent. In fact, they're more likely to be the victims of violence. It is a very, very small population of individuals with certain types of psychiatric conditions, certain types of neuropsychological deficits, ones that begin to lead them to become delusional or overtly psychotic, where they're losing that ability to track right from wrong, where it would make sense at all to begin to kind of think about how we would track that. And so that's why that's a fairly hot button issue, because many people out there do have psychological disorders and they would never perpetrate any type of gun violence or violence.
But then those shootings that we hear about that then make international news are so often, are they not, perpetrated by people who do have some sort of serious mental health issue?
Yes, and I think that's where we're coming to kind of a flashpoint of what are we going to do about this, is that even though what I just said is very much what I think most mental health advocacy organizations would want to help people understand about the relationship to mental illness and violence, is that there is a small subset of the population who will, for various reasons, come to believe that this is something that they need to do, want to do, or they are so angry at some group of people or some individual that this is the only way that they can come to retribution or manage this. I do think that finding ways to address that and understand that is important. It's just paying attention to the other part of the system, and that is the mental health system, is that we're not very good at identifying who's going to do that and who's not going to do it. There's no one diagnosis. There's no one predictive behavior that is going to predict who's going to do that. And so we really are kind of stuck. And so until we work on more precise ways to identify that and collect the right kind of data that allows us to predict who is at risk for that type of behavior, we're in a bit of a difficult position.
So does that mean then, when we're going back to my original hypothetical scenario, I'm going to purchase a handgun, my criminal background is checked to see if there's any kind of history, but unless my mental health history has led me to some sort of criminal act, there's no way that anyone can know what's going on there. Is that right? I mean, I see this as a potentially a pretty big privacy issue, but is that how it is right now?
Well, unless there's a court judgment that you were not by the court judged as mentally competent, and that would be a part of the court record. And also, when you apply for the permit, under the current law, you have to you're asked to sign a waiver that would allow the sheriff's department to actually do health checks, to include a mental health check. How valid that is, and how important it is, I'm not sure. If I could pick up though on Rich's comment, and I'm sure Todd would want to comment on this. Well. And you mentioned these international incidents that folks talk about. I think in any community in America, we've got to remain focused and concerned about what's happening in our town. And all towns are not the same. In less than 2.5 months here in Wilmington, at my last count, we have had 10 murders in greater Wilmington. And it appears through open source. In 9 of those 10, the people knew each other. They were in some kind of a relationship. Two of the perpetrators of those crimes are 17. One was 19. One victim was 17. It's alleged that a grandson shot his grandfather. It's alleged that folks that were in domestic relationships, one chased and gunned down his partner. When we look at that, the issue to me and most of us truly is about violence and what causes people in relationship, where most of our murders take place, 7 of those 10 being gunshot murders in 2.5 months, what causes them to move so quickly in a conflict, in an argument, to violence? And then you have the issue, and we can certainly debate that. If a gun is available, that can often become a default. I have a friend of mine in our group talks often about an incident when he was much younger, a neighborhood dispute with a man across the street. He's still a gun owner now, and he actually went into his house, went into his bedroom nightstand, took his revolver out and started to leave the house to go back and confront his neighbor, and stopped and said to himself, "What am I doing?" I'm afraid that doesn't happen as much as it should. So in that sense, is it about more guns or access to guns or less guns? I think it's about this underlying issue of violence in our society, violence in our culture, and violence in our community. More guns or less guns is just a response to violence. It's not a solution.
Todd Adkins.
Wow. A number of things I would like to respond to. First, I don't want your listeners to come away with the belief that, in fact, when in North Carolina, when you purchase a long gun and when you purchase a handgun, the sheriff is going to be doing this background check. There are mental health disqualifiers in federal and state law. If you have been adjudicated as a mental defective and or involuntarily committed to a mental institution, you are disqualified from owning or possessing a firearm. So that check is conducted today. And I think what the professor was talking about earlier is really important for us to recognize, is that there is a knee-jerk response when some of these horrific acts take place in our communities. And we should focus on all of and think about all of the available means at our disposal to help prevent such tragedies. But at the same time, as he pointed out, accurately so, is that of the multitude of mental health disorders, only very, very few, a very minute percentage of the American public, actually pose a risk to themselves or others. So when we come up with these carte blanche or these very broad statements about what we need to do to prevent such tragedies from occurring in the future, we have to be very careful about who we're stigmatizing, how we're overgeneralizing a response, making just a categorical response, because we are, at the end of the day, talking about the constitutional rights of otherwise law-abiding men and women in this country. So we can't just allow that immediate, you know, 3-hour in the aftermath of these terrible events to kind of force us to want to create brand new categories of entire rafts of people we want to just exclude from the ability to exercise their constitutional rights. Because even though in the modern media environment it appears to be happening with great regularity, at the same time it is still a very small percentage of the American public that pose a risk to themselves or others. And I would add to that that, again, this the media cycle we're always in now, if it bleeds, it leads. Violent crime in this country has fallen from its, you know, the high of the early 1990s to basement levels. Now, are we done? Of course we're not done. And of course we all need to work together to continue to reduce murder and other violent crimes to the extent we can. But we have to recognize that we've also come a long way while the American public has been purchasing firearms in record numbers. So we have to recognize that, again, the approaches we take, we are talking about a constitutional right, and we just don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of these younger people, because Don Arabian, when you were talking about some of the murders that have happened here in Wilmington, a lot of those incidents have involved very young people. Are college students currently permitted to carry a weapon around campus, Don Arabian?
No, we don't currently have a campus carry law in the state. It has been proposed in this session. I don't know where it is at the moment. Todd might know. There's an omnibus bill that should come back to the floor today, whether it contains campus carry or not. As originally proposed, it would have been a concealed carry, which would put the age minimum age at 21, and as a result of that, it wouldn't apply to most undergraduate students.
Richard Ogle, when we're talking about younger people and how they make decisions, is it not established that the part of the brain that deals with judgment isn't fully developed until well into someone's 20s?
Yeah, we know so much more about neurodevelopment now than we did even 7 to 10 years ago, and our understanding of that is rapidly improving. It is the case generally for about males, full frontal lobe development is not occurred till about 22, 23 years old. For females, as you probably would expect, it's a little younger, probably 19 or 20 years old. And so I do think there are some scientific advances and some data that certainly should be used to help make decisions about, again, what we all talked about and what we all three agreed on, and that is mitigation of risk. What are the contexts in which it's okay? What are the contexts in which it's not okay? And so using data, using what we know that is much more established empirical fact to help make us the decision, make these decisions is, I think, a great idea. And that's one that we know now that we didn't know that long ago.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about gun laws in North Carolina, gun violence, and where those ideas intersect. Our guests today are Richard Ogle, professor of psychology and associate dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. We also have Todd Adkins with us by phone. He's the director of research and information for the National Rifle Association's Institute for Legislative Action. And Don Arabian, he is co-founder and co-chair of Wilmington Faiths Against Gun Violence. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Noel from Chapel Hill, you've done both. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Just wanted to chime in from the perspective of the grassroots gun supporters here in North Carolina. And our friends at the NRA there are doing obviously a very capable job helping to explain that this is much less about psychology or what have you, and more about the constitutional rights of law-abiding citizens. You know, when you break it down and start looking at the numbers, the United States falls way down the list in terms of per capita murders. And then if you start excising places like, you know, heavily gun-controlled Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, and start removing all of those murders that you see happening in those places, and you take the incidence of gun ownership in the rest of America, which are who you're talking about here, law-abiding gun owners, the rate of murders per capita is very, 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 very low, down near the bottom, of all countries on the planet. And so, when we're talking about all kinds of other things, that don't have to do with the facts, we are obfuscating and ignoring, the issue. The issue here is, the individual ought to have the right to protect themselves.
Thank you so much. I think you've made your point. Thanks so much for your call, Noel. Don Arabian, you're squirming in your chair.
It's because it's a lousy seat. I'm uncomfortable. but I just would say that in terms of what the caller said and what Todd said, certainly there is the Second Amendment right to bear arms. And we all have to decide where we stand on the right of what self-protection means and what does that mean to you or me in my life. We have, quite honestly, no right in this country that doesn't also come with responsibility. And I think for each of us, you have to decide what is the responsibility associated with the right to bear arms. What is the responsibility of freedom of speech associated with the right to freedom of speech, and on and on.
Don Arabian, you are not an anti-gun person.
No.
That's not where you're coming from. Why did you start this organization, Wilmington Faiths Against Gun Violence?
I, like so many other folks, are tired of violence. And I'm tired of the fact that we have not been able, on the issue of guns and gun violence, to get beyond the rhetoric that I feel so often defines the issue and really talk about those things. And we are a little bit today talking about violence.
What's an example of the rhetoric that defines the issue? What do you mean by that?
Well, on either side, you've got folks who want to melt all guns, which is totally, in my view, unrealistic, and folks who say my Second Amendment right doesn't require a responsibility associated with that right. And as has been said today, 99.999% of all gun owners are responsible. But many responsible gun owners understand and agree that there is a need for mitigation of risk. What that is and what that ought to be is where we need to have the discussion, where we need to talk, and where we have to stop stopping at gun once the gun is mentioned, as I talked about earlier, and run to the two corners. Self-protection works both ways. I want to know that when I'm out on the street without a gun, that those who have guns on the street should have guns. And that's where our discussion ought to be. What does that actually mean? And
Todd Adkins, going back to this idea of students on college campuses carrying weapons, does the NRA see that if that passes, and I do think that is an element of this omnibus gun legislation, House Bill 588, does that make a college campus safer in the eyes of the NRA?
Well, you know, I'd like to if we go back to the initial discussion regarding concealed carry in North Carolina in the early 1990s, a lot of the rhetoric is now being repeated about both permitless carry and campus carry. What our experience in this country over the past three decades shows us, that is where with this right to carry movement started in Florida and moved to other states, including North Carolina and most others, is that law-abiding citizens will exercise their right to defend themselves in entirely appropriate ways. Right?
And Todd, I'm going to let you finish that point when we come back from this break.
Okay.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a discussion today about North Carolina's current gun laws and how pending legislation stacks up against national trends. With us today, Don Arabian of Wilmington Faiths Against Gun Violence, Todd Adkins of the NRA, and Richard Ogle, a clinical psychologist from UNCW. When we come back from this break, you'll have one more segment to get your own question in on this Wednesday. You can do that by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's an exploration of current gun laws in North Carolina, which proposals are making their way through the General Assembly this session, and how national trends on gun laws are showing up here. Our guests today, Richard Ogle, professor of psychology at UNCW. He's also the associate dean of the College of Arts and Sciences there. Don Arabian is with us today. He's co-founder and co-chair of Wilmington Faiths Against Gun Violence. And Todd Adkins is director of research and information for the National Rifle Association's Institute for Legislative Action. If you'd like to ask your own question on this Wednesday, you can call us today at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Todd Adkins of the NRA, just before we went to break, I promised you'd get to finish your point about the way we view and talk about open carry and concealed carry, and whether students walking around on campus with weapons would make the campus a safer place.
Right. So I was just taking folks through a quick history of concealed carry generally in North Carolina and throughout the country. Our experience has been positive, but I would say more to the point, we'd like our campuses to be perfectly safe, but they are not. And for individuals attending college, working at a college or university, they should have the right to defend themselves. Again, we think of colleges as bucolic, and they are generally safe. I don't want to overstate that, but at the same time, violent crime can strike anywhere, and we think law-abiding citizens, students on campus, faculty members on campus, staff members on campus, should have the right to defend themselves against violent attack, because, again, perpetrators of violence don't concern themselves with where guns are allowed or prohibited. In fact, the majority of cases when firearms are misused, that firearm is illegally possessed to begin with. So they're not going to pay attention to where we exclude firearms for the law-abiding. So we think that that right to defend yourself should be afforded to everybody on a college campus, and that, of course, includes students.
There is also a piece of legislation that was sponsored by Pricey Harrison, who I believe is a seven-term Democrat from Guilford County. And this piece of legislation, Don Arabian, would essentially repeal the Stand Your Ground defense in North Carolina. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, HB 723 had a number of aspects to it, and that was one. There were about seven or eight pieces. On the Stand Your Ground piece, yes, it did push back, but it certainly did not take away the right of an individual for self-protection in the home. If I can make one comment, though, on what Todd just said, and I certainly agree that everybody has the right to defend themselves, and people on campus should as well. Our issue with the bill as originally written and proposed for campus carry in North Carolina is basically twofold. One is that it's a very thin one-page document originally that then transferred into about four lines in the omnibus bill. It does not and did not offer an opportunity, which we think is very important in this case, for faculty, students, administrators throughout of the state to have an opportunity to discuss in a public way, in a public forum, and express their views of how they feel about campus carry. Having talked to some local student groups in the past 2 months and faculty members here in town, UNCW, because we are a campus. And it's a small sampling, and I would state that up front. Vast majority of folks were concerned, and the vast majority of folks are also concerned about how it might be implemented. For example, would a professor be able to designate their office as a gun-free zone? What happens in complexes such as the Wilson Center downtown, which is part of Cape Fear Community College, where students work, where many of us go to see performances all of the time? Would students then be allowed, or would that's considered on campus? Would folks be carrying there, carrying in a way that isn't currently permitted under some other type of law? So the intimate nature of UNCW, the intimate nature of Cape Fear with our community means that it's important to all of us, but it's particularly important to that campus community, and they need to be heard from. So we're suggesting that let's take a reasoned approach, let's have an open debate and discussion among folks who that this impacts, gun owners and non-gun owners alike, folks that are concerned about self-protection and those that are concerned about having guns on campus.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We have Michael from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question about what the gun laws in North Carolina were with respect to becoming a gun owner through inheritance.
Don Arabian.
If it's a handgun, the sheriff's permitting system applies for making that transfer. If it's a long gun, it does not apply. That's as I understand it.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much for your call, Michael. And we have Dylan. Dylan, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm tuning in a little late, so I hope that this hasn't already been addressed. But I am one of those people that this would affect. I teach at a local college. And sometimes I hear this people who are advocates for guns on campus making an argument that I think oversimplifies the issue, saying, boy, if you were in your classroom, Mr. Patterson, and someone, a crazed lunatic, was in the hallway with a gun killing people, wouldn't you want to have a gun at that moment? And I say, certainly I'd want to have a gun at that moment, but that's not really the choice you have. The choice you have is, do you have multiple guns on campus, maybe over the course of not just that day, but 4 years. 4 years of parties, 4 years of arguments, 4 years of coming home drunk, 4 years of... And so when we do kind of the cost-benefit analysis of this, I think four years of my girlfriend broke up with me and I have undiagnosed depression and I have a handgun under my bed. So I think I'd like to hear, especially from your guests from the NRA, of doing that kind of risk assessment of having a gun on campus for, 4 years worth. And especially people, these are students for the most part whose frontal lobes, if your frontal lobe, which affects your impulse control, is not really fully formed to your 25. We've got folks that are
okay. So Dylan,
18 on campus.
Dylan, yeah. you're raising the age of the completion of the frontal lobe. We did have a discussion a little earlier in the show.
That's commonly cited as 25. Yeah.
Yes, and that's a great point. Todd Adkins from the NRA, what do you say about this? The tumultuousness of the college years and the emotional ups and downs and all of the tremendous stress on people. Are those the people who should have access to guns?
Well, and I certainly appreciate folks, this would be new in North Carolina, and I fully appreciate that. Our experience from other states, some states with many, many years allowing firearms on college campuses, has not borne out any of these facts and these fears. And that's why I was talking about the general history with concealed carry. If you can imagine, the very same debate took place in North Carolina in the early 90s before we had a permitting system for law-abiding citizens to carry concealed. It was every traffic accident will end up with a shootout. Every bar fight will have shootouts. And at some level, I understand that people, because something's new, that they will register some fear about it. But our experience with folks who conceal carry to defend themselves and members of their family show that routinely law-abiding citizens continue to engage in law-abiding behavior. And our experience with campus carry in particular throughout the country has been routinely the same. And I know we've come to an age now where we think of young people as highly irresponsible, et cetera, but I find a lot of young people to be exactly the opposite. After all, we have many young people who fight our wars and engage in battles for us. And a lot of the young people that I know personally are entirely responsible, and our experience throughout the country has shown them to be so. When we engage in a campus carry debate, when we engage in a permit list debate, and when we engage in the initial fight over concealed carry systems themselves back in the 90s throughout the country, including North Carolina, the evidence doesn't come forward that any of these fears actually exist in the real world. And that's what I'm trying to say about campus carry and permit list carry in North Carolina this year, is it's the same risks are raised, the same fears are raised. And what we find is just everybody's common sense understanding that law-abiding citizens are just that actually is proven over and over again, time and time again, throughout the country, in all of the various states, regarding all of these various approaches and derivatives of concealed carry generally.
Richard Ogle, you have some interesting data on who is more likely to become a victim of gun violence. And you've said that women are more likely to be victimized by current or former partners, and men more likely to be victimized by acquaintances. What does that tell us about how to start addressing the expression of gun violence?
I think it speaks to something that Dawn alluded to earlier, and that it does seem to be the case, regardless of where and how you look at the data, depending on who's disseminating it, is that when gun violence happens, well over half, depending on the statistics, anywhere from probably 60 to 70% of the time, the victim is somebody that is known by the perpetrator, that there is some level of acquaintance. And when you look at it, when the victim is a male, it's usually the perpetrator is a male and it's in some kind of public situation, as you said. And when it's a female, it's more often than not somebody that is an intimate partner of theirs. And so I think what that goes back to is what we talked about at the beginning, is trying to understand the nature of what are the conditions that incite a person like Don's neighbor to take that initial step to go into their house, pick up a gun, and use it to resolve a conflict. Some of those have to do with an individual's psychological makeup, individuals who believe that aggression is an appropriate response to conflict, an appropriate way to mediate a conflict.
And is there a certain point in someone's life when they learn how to deal with feelings of aggression, either to act it out in the form of violence or not?
I think it's ongoing. Certainly individuals who are always able, if willing to change, you can see that shifting in and out of likelihood over the course of a lifespan. That said, when you start seeing individuals who are prone to aggressive behavior between 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, individuals who, when you talk to them about conflict, view in general other people as out to get them or working hostily toward them, even if clearly no one else feels that way when they look at the situation, those are kind of the seeds of what we see in terms of developing an issue with aggression and violence. And so as Todd says, the vast majority of individuals are law-abiding. The vast majority of individuals who own guns do not perpetrate violence. The issue is, how do we address the public health problem of individuals who do become violent and use firearms? Again, knowing that that is a minority, but it is an issue that I think we need to look at beyond constitutional rights, in the sense of we need to look at what are the factors that predict that and help us kind of mitigate that.
Don Arabian, you're doing some – Wilmington Faiths Against Gun Violence is doing some work with Blue Ribbon Commission and some other nonprofits around town.
A bunch of nonprofits.
What kind of work are you doing with those groups?
Well, we're not a nonprofit ourselves, but we're finding because we're not competing for grant funds. So we can do a number of things that can help bring nonprofits together. A lot of great folks doing a lot of excellent work to try to work with kids in our town, particularly kids. And as somebody who's not going after funds, we can get them to resource fairs. We can help reach out back into the communities that are associated with us to get them resources. And we're doing a variety of things like that. We're also taking on one at a time opportunities to help local families and folks who sometimes are more than one strike against them, find work, get out of the situation that they're in, and lead hopefully to better tomorrow. Why is that important? And it's important on several levels. In our town, it really is important to understand that we have kids in this town under the age of 12 who go around packing a gun from time to time for self-defense. It happens in our town. I've talked to them. I know who some of them are.
And under what circumstances would they be able to put down that gun? I mean, this really is...
Put down the gun or...
Yes. In other words, you say for self-defense, it's
right.
Not as a show of aggression.
No, they're not going to. But that is the reality of where a lot of our folks live. But it then moves around to something that Todd talked about, and I couldn't agree with them more. The vast majority of folks are legitimate gun owners. But in this town, folks who have gotten a gun legitimately have used it the wrong way.
That's this edition of Coastline. Todd Adkins, Don Arabian, Richard Ogle, thank you all so much for joining us today. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast. Find it on the HQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3. Join us for Coastline Live, Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon.
here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.